Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for CEO Exclusive, brought to you by Annona Enterprises.
Good morning, everyone. With us this morning, we have Mark Samuels and Dr. Shabir Bambot at LumaMed, CEO and CTO. And, you know, they have a really innovative treatment that allows for more precise surgical procedures, in particular, the removal of cancers. And so I would love it if you guys would, first of all, tell us a little bit about the company and then tell us a little bit about the trends that you're seeing with medical devices and cancer treatment that make you think that your device is something that's needed in the marketplace.
Well, let's talk a little bit about cancer. Unfortunately, cancer kills a lot of people in the United States. In fact, about 25% of all deaths are due to cancer. And if you have cancer, one of the first things you're going to do is you want to get it out of your body. So if it's a solid tumor, you'll have surgery to remove the tumor. Unfortunately, surgeons really don't have a way of seeing cancer while they're actually operating. They get a lot of information before the surgery from CAT scans and MRIs and all sorts of things. But when they actually have the scalpel in their hand, they're essentially operating blind. And this is especially important in breast cancer, where if you do breast-conserving surgery or a lumpectomy, you're trying to remove the tumor but leave as much breast cancer, as much breast tissue.
Yeah, don't want to leave the cancer.
No, we don't want to leave the cancer. So as much healthy breast tissue as possible. And today's state of the art, about a third of the operations for breast cancer surgery result in missed cancer, and they have to go back and do a second operation.
How many?
About a third, 33%. Wow. And it varies from institution to institution, but that's probably about the average. I mean, some places it's as high as 70% reoperation rate. So that's the problem that LumaMed is trying to solve, and the way we solve it is we provide an image to the surgeon during the operation that lets them know whether they've gotten all the cancer out. And the nice thing is, because everything is validated by a pathology after the operation, we never make a life or death decision. But we think we can improve those statistics and take that 33% down to under 10 or maybe under 5%.
Wow. And so is it just breast cancer or other cancers as well?
Well, we're starting out in breast cancer because we think that's where the need is the strongest. We also have a significant amount of data in skin cancer for use during Mohs surgery. Which is a type of specialized skin cancer surgery where a pathologist, a person who's trained as a pathologist and a dermatologist, removes tissue and then looks at it right there while you're still in the office. It's time-consuming and expensive, and so we think we can make a difference there. And then any other area where you're trying to save tissue, like in brain cancer surgery, liver cancer, pancreatic cancer, we think that could be valuable in those areas, but we don't have data yet.
Mm. Shabir, where does this technology come from?
So we actually licensed this technology from two institutions, Providence Hospital up in Oregon and Massachusetts General Hospital up in Boston. And both institutions recognize our backgrounds in this area, and so they were happy to license this technology to us, given, you know, their belief, their faith in us being able to commercialize this.
And so how is it actually a technology or a device that you're selling? What is it? What does LumaMed actually sell?
Well, it'll sell a device, but the device is based on this technology. It's called polarization subtraction imaging. So it's a very unique, very powerful technology that gives a very high-resolution images of the surface of tissue that has been removed during surgery. So you can, and it gives a high degree of contrast between cancer and normal tissue. So you can actually see the cancer, which is hard to do in the operating room just using the naked eye.
Mm-hmm. And have you had any surgeons or any tests with the technology as of yet?
Yes. So we've actually, there have been at least a couple of papers that have been published in breast cancer and quite a few papers in skin cancer. Both of those, these are peer-reviewed publications that show the power of this technology and how this technology can delineate cancers on the surface of tissue. And we're working with prominent surgeons in this space.
Mm-hmm. And so where are you in the life cycle of the business right now?
So we've actually, we really started operations back in 2013. We won an NIH SBIR award to help us, you know, start the operation. We've built devices that have been tested. They work according to our specifications, and they're being now used in a clinical study up at the University of Massachusetts, up in Worcester, at the hospital there.
Mm-hmm. And so, what do you expect is going to be the growth of the use of it, of this device? Can it be used pretty much in every surgery that involves cancer?
So that's an interesting question. We believe so, because our device is fairly generic. If you look at our device, it looks like a tabletop scanner. And the device doesn't really care what kind of tissue is placed on it. We are testing it on breast cancer. But we believe that any solid tumor that is removed from the body is a candidate for evaluation with our device. And in fact, when we've taken our devices at the clinics that we're in, and we've talked to quite a few surgeons, there has been an interest from people, for example, surgeons performing brain cancer surgery or head and neck surgery. These people would like to use our device in their surgical procedures. So we believe there's going to be a pull in those areas once the device is already out there for breast cancer surgeons. Mm-hmm.
And so, Mark, are you finding that, you know, you guys have launched medical device companies before? Are you finding that the process is getting easier or more difficult? And, you know, what are you facing in terms of regulatory obstacles?
The process is much more difficult now than it was in the late 90s, 2000 timeframe. I started a company in the 90s, took it public, became a NASDAQ company. Through that process, we raised private capital, then venture capital, and then, of course, public equity. Yeah. It is much more.
What was the market cap when you guys went public?
Market cap was about $70 million when we went public.
Right. So not a little itty-bitty company, no.
Well, I mean, it's small by some standards.
Yeah.
But certainly what we've observed is there has been a significant reduction in the amount of venture capital that's available. In fact, the latest numbers show that venture capital has dropped by about 50% for medical device companies since 2007. And that's not just the drop that is the telling indicator. The other issue is that the venture capitalists have started investing in much more mature companies. So essentially, there are certain exceptions, of course, but typically a venture capitalist now will not invest in a company that's pre-revenue, which creates a huge funding gap, because a typical medical device company, many of them there have, you know, sophisticated technology, not you know, maybe something beyond a new kneecap or something, something that has software, electronics, optics like ours. You know, it might cost $10-15 million to get to market
and take a few years too.
And so, doing that without venture capital is extremely difficult. And so, you sort of have a chicken and egg situation now in the medical device industry. Some of this is due to the perceptions in the venture capital industry about FDA risk, because there is a general feeling that FDA risk has gone up. And I mentioned to you before the show that we plan to launch in the United States, but many of our peers are launching outside the United States because they feel like the barriers are too high to sort of bet their company's future on launching in the United States first.
And are they finding that to be a viable strategy?
Lots of companies are finding that to be a viable strategy. The U.S. market is still very large and very lucrative, so nobody wants to ignore it. Lots of companies do launch in Europe before they launch in the United States. That allows them to establish some revenue. And, you know, we've used this model before. I had a product that my public company, the name of that company is Guided Therapeutics. We launched a product called the BillyCheck for infant jaundice detection. And we launched that in Europe before the United States while we're waiting on FDA approval. But that strategy has become more common as the FDA has become less predictable.
And so, from your experience, what's the difference in both the time frame and the cost associated with launching in Europe versus launching in the U.S.?
Probably it's not so much cost, it's time frame.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a PMA product, which we have judiciously worked on avoiding.
Well, for the benefit of our listeners who may not be familiar with that term, what does that mean?
Well, if you do something, and we're talking about devices now, not drugs, so we don't have to, you're not talking about trying to figure out safety in terms of something someone's going to take in their body. If you're talking about a device, if it's completely new, the FDA has a process that is quite long and arduous called a pre-market approval. And that can take years, 5 to 6 years probably on average, to get through that process. You have to have extensive clinical studies to show safety and efficacy. You have to, the products that are used in the clinical have to be built in your final factory with all your final tooling and everything, so you don't get to use sort of prototype gear to do those clinicals. And it's just very expensive and time-consuming. And also, there's a high degree of unpredictability. There's sort of a joke in the industry that no FDA person has ever been fired for not approving something.
Mm. So what's the difference in the time frame?
The time frame, I think time frames have essentially doubled. And I think it's not so much the time frame that is the issue as is uncertainty. There's a great deal of, you know, and that affects the ability to finance the medical device companies, which is why LumaMed chose something that is clearly an FDA 510K, which is a process where you are essentially saying that there is something similar to your product out in the market, either exactly the same or similar enough, so that there are no new issues, you're not raising any new issues of safety and effectiveness. And it turns out, luckily for us, that there are some devices that are cameras to look for oral cancer that we can use as the industry calls a predicate device. And that helps us to be able to get through the FDA. It also helps us in that we are not, as I said before, we're not making a life or death decision. Every indication we give, which is by showing an image to a physician that they have to interpret, we don't actually tell them what's cancer and what's not. They look at the image and make an interpretation like you would on an X-ray. But all those decisions are backed up by the pathology just as it's currently done. So in terms of patient safety, there's no, LumaMed doesn't have a chance of impacting patient safety.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the world of all the different technologies that you could have chosen, why did you guys choose to, Shabir, why did you choose to license this one?
So, you know, we've spent our careers working in what you would call the diagnostic space. Whether it's the BillyCheck device or some of the other work we've done, we've actually have a device that we launched in detecting cervical cancer. What we wanted to do is to kind of move downstream, meaning not necessarily do a diagnostic, because a diagnostic device typically is a yes or no test. It tells you whether you have a certain disease or not. And that leads you to, as Mark said, perhaaps a more arduous regulatory path. We wanted to do something, A, downstream, and B, something that would take us, you know, on a regulatory path that was a simpler and faster path. And so we looked for technologies that were in the cancer space that could help people who have cancer and then, you know, be able to take that technology to market fairly quickly. So one of the advantages of the technology that we have is that we're not trying to diagnose cancer. We already know that these people who come in for surgery have cancer. What we're trying to do is to figure out, has the surgeon been able to take all of that cancer out? And so from a intellectual or a technology point of view, it's actually a simpler problem because we're not trying to, you know, tell cancer apart from non-cancer. We're basically, we know there's already cancer there. All we're trying to do is the surface of the tissue that has been removed, is that free of cancer?
And so what's the likely price point for this, for your device?
Well, that's going to depend on the final configuration, which we're approaching. But it will be under, the device price would be under, well under $100,000 into the hospital. And that's a good price point because that means it can be approved probably at the department level rather than having to go, you know, to the whole hospital committee like it would be if you were doing a $3 million X-ray machine or something like that. Mm-hmm. We also have a single-use disposable that is associated with the device. From the company's point of view, we get paid when we sell the product, the actual instrument, which is about the size of a microwave, and then we have a single-use disposable that is required for each operation.
Hmm. And so, would LumaMed be in every surgical suite?
It would be in surgical suites that are focused in the breast cancer area. So a hospital would have one or two, probably not more than that. I mean, there may be some hospitals that might have three, but one or two units. And then you'd also be in surgical sites that are outside the hospital where a lot of lumpectomies are done.
Great. And so you guys have obviously worked together before, right? You mentioned guided therapeutics, and so tell me a little bit about how you met each other. How did you guys come to start this business together?
Well, in the late 90s, Guided Therapeutics was trying to decide where it was going to go next. And so Shabir was brought in as PhD scientist to start looking at various areas. And we looked at lots of different things, he and I during that period of time. That was around the time that Guided Therapeutics went public. So we had a little bit of money, but we were trying to figure out, we already have a few things in the pipeline. What do we do next? And as a team, we settled on cancer diagnostics as being the right area. And then that was later focused into cervical cancer. And Shabir headed up and worked did that cervical cancer team on the technical side until essentially the product was launched. The product is actually in the market now, being sold by Guided Therapeutics. Shabir, you want to say something about the LaViva product?
Sure. So it's a product that is intended to triage women who have been found to have an abnormal Pap test. In the United States, the Pap test has, as you probably know, has done a lot in terms of reducing mortality from cervical cancer over the years. But there's a flip side to that coin, and that is that with that has come this large number of women who are now being found to have disease who actually don't. So we kind of cast this wide net. We catch a lot of people. It's called, there's a low specificity, if you will, to the Pap test. And so in general, I would say about 60 million women in the United States have a Pap test, and then about 10% of them are found to have an abnormal result, when in fact, less than 500,000 have treatable disease. And so what we do is we end up subjecting a lot of women unnecessarily through a lot of invasive procedures. And so what this device that we built is intended to do and is being used overseas is to kind of reduce that burden, reduce the number of women, and find only those women who actually need the treatment. It's basically comes in as a secondary test after the Pap test, and it wants to enrich the population of women who actually need treatment. And so it uses spectroscopy. We use visible light to do our test, and that's basically the same technology, that same thought process that has come forward into LumaMed, into our products over here.
Got it. And so you guys have been together for what, 20 years?
Pretty much.
To 20 years. I left as CEO of Guided Therapeutics in 2007, and I needed a break. I'd been running a public company for 10 years. Some of it was really good. Some of it was really bad. So I'd been out a couple of years, and Shabir approached me and said he wanted to start a company. And so we started looking at various technologies, and that process took a little while. But we sort of settled into the LumaMed idea, really probably around the 2010 timeframe for a focus on skin cancer, and then in 2011 we brought in Mass General Hospital, who had some data in breast, and then of course funding was an issue, and we didn't get our SBIR funds until 2013 to start operations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what is it that you think makes your relationship work? Like, why do you think that you guys clicked?
Constant bickering. constant bickering would be what an observer would.
Yeah, we were actually joking about that coming in, and he was like, north and south poles, and so we said, well, of course, well then those two will attract.
So we come from a diverse background. We have different technical abilities, different cultural biases and things, and somehow know that works out very well. We've done an amazing job, sort of patting ourselves on the back in terms of the amount of money and resources that have gone into LumaMed for where we are. We have two working instruments, a clinical that is well underway. And these instruments are. They're not the most complicated instruments in the world, but they have optics and light sources and detectors and CCDs and software and moving parts and You know, there's all sorts of things in these boxes. And so to have done that with a small team on the budget that we have, I think is quite remarkable.
Yeah, we kind of complement each other in terms of skills and in terms of strategy as well. And so, yeah, absolutely. These are, yes, they're, you know, similar devices have been built before, but there's a great deal of complexity in them.
Mm. And so, you know, as you guys mentioned, you're bickering. How do you negotiate conflict? Because I know that, you know, as partners in a small enterprise, you know, it's something that comes up all the time. So when you have differing ideas and when there's conflict, how do you guys resolve that?
Well, if I may, I think we try to stay objective. You know, we let the science, we let the technology rule. We try our best to make sure that, you know, personal biases or you know, individual prejudices, whatever you have, you know, as human beings, we're different, obviously. But we try to let the science rule. We try to make sure that whatever is on the table, we give it an objective look, and we just discuss things on its merits.
Mm-hmm. So it's like a debate team. There's a debate, and logic is used until we reach some point where there's an unknown, and the unknown has to be resolved by experiment usually. And so then the experiment is done, and then that usually points the direction that we need to go. If it's a business decision, a lot of times in a small company, you really don't have a lot of choices because you're driven by lack of resources, you know, lack of capital. And so there's and I've been through this many times. There's the right way that you would like to do things, and then there's the way that you have to do it because that's the resources that you have. And I think that was a little bit of an adjustment for Shabir when he first came to Lumen because, you know, quit. You know, a job as a chief technical officer of Guided Therapeutics, a public company, to come to essentially, two guys walk into an empty lab with to set their briefcase down, and there's no furniture or anything, and so, we adapt to the conditions that we're faced with in terms of being able to make decisions that are needed.
Mm. How many medical devices have you launched, Mark?
I have three FDA-approved products that are out. I have launched products for insulin and insulin infusion devices, which are not probably the only non-optical based devices that are out there. We did a line of insulin infusion devices called the Simple Choice line as part of the public company. I launched the BillyCheck, which is extremely successful. It's owned now by Philips Medical. It's used worldwide. It's financially extremely good for them. And it's also, I like to think that my karma has improved because I've stopped probably 5 or 6 million babies from having a blood test. Instead of having a blood test, they've had a beam of light shined on their forehead like a flashlight to get the answer. And so I've saved a lot of pain in the world, I like to tell my daughter. And there's a couple.
She may not agree on the good karma thing.
And then, of course, I claim, Luviva was actually launched after I left, but I claimed that as a product, the cervical cancer product. But it was certainly the, there was 10 years of effort put into that before I left, and mm-hmm. And I claimed that as a product. And then I have a couple commercial products. I mentioned before the show that I did some of the laser speed guns for the police to use way back in the day, and those are, of course, on the market. But they're not medical, but they are optical, and I think all the optical technology sort of has been a main theme of the products. Most of the products I've developed have been use lasers or light or spectroscopy, which is spectroscopy is basically taking light and breaking it down like a rainbow into its different colors and trying to understand something about what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm. So this obviously is not your first time at the rodeo.
No, it's not.
So then with that, what do you expect of for the life cycle of LumaMed?
Well, ideally, we will... get through this phase that we're in and become adequately funded and push the products into the market. When you push products into the market, when you launch products, that's sort of just the beginning of your work because now you have to go and convince doctors who are historically very conservative to use your device. Luckily, breast cancer surgeons seem to be really clamoring for this. I mean, they want something to help them. No breast cancer surgeon wants to go and tell their patient that they missed the cancer and they're going to have to reoperate. They don't want to do that. And they're not even though reimbursement and cost containment is a big issue. Luckily, if you can avoid that second operation, you save actually a lot of money. It's better for the patient. It's better for the hospital, especially these days, because they're getting penalized for readmissions and for missing things. And I think it's better for the surgeon, because the surgeon who can do a better job in breast cancer surgery is the surgeon who's going to do more surgeries, because women are very careful about making a choice of something as personal as breast cancer surgery. And so if they're using a Lumimed device, we think that'll be an advantage.
Mm-hmm. And so you expect what kind of growth, and are you looking at potential?
We think Lumimed has an opportunity to be, in terms of revenue, to be a $100 million company in about 5 years after we launch the product. It's that kind of opportunity. Now, compared to Facebook, that looks really small. And I like to say, when you go to the hospital, you know, you can't do everything with an iPhone app. Somebody actually has to have an instrument to help you.
For now. You know, one of these days they're going to be able to remove cancer with an iPhone app, but, you know, we're getting there.
You know, a lot of money chases that sort of thing. I think it would be better for our country if more money would be put toward medical device type. But $100 million, we think, and with really healthy margins because of the disposable. But we are, you know, and then there people always say, do you want to do another IPO? It's very difficult being a public company. I was a public company. I managed through the whole Sarbanes-Oxley changes that were brought on by the Enron scandal and the WorldCom scandal. And so we, in terms of exit strategy, we have a choice between an IPO or being acquired. But I think acquisition is the more likely, because there are a lot of medical companies that are very big in women's healthcare. And imaging is a part of what they do. And essentially, you know, the simplest way to describe Lumimed is we have a special camera that can help a surgeon see cancer. It doesn't tell them where the cancer is, but it helps them see it. Sort of like if you were looking at an apple in the grocery store and you can see there's a rotten spot on the side. It helps them see it in a different way. And I think that fits very well with a lot of large companies.
Mm-hmm. And so you're thinking that you're going to actually build the company to a $100 million company,
Before acquisition.
Yeah.
You can't really run a company to be acquired. You have to run a company to be successful.
Right.
And so, you know, we have to build a very strong, you know, a strong company that is capable of going public, because that is you get a lot of scrutiny when you go public. You have to do everything right. There's a big level of responsibility if you go public. So you have to build a company with a good, strong foundation, and then run it to be successful, and then acquisition, IPO, all that stuff, and eventual liquidity, it will come.
Right. Absolutely. So with that, what do you expect for the near-term future for Lumimed? What are you looking at over the next few months or year or so?
Well, we have some clinical activity underway right now. So we need to complete that clinical activity, which is going on in Massachusetts at Mass Memorial Hospital in Worcester. We need to then expand our clinicals, because we really, you know, one site's really not enough. You really need to have a three or four sites. We'd like to get some data also in Europe. We'd like to go ahead and complete our regulatory path of the 510K and get that so we can launch in the U.S. If there's any delays there, we would probably launch outside the U.S. And we have to build the infrastructure to be able to support all that. And, of course, it requires capital. So capital is something that we have to acquire in order to move the company forward.
Mm-hmm. And when are you looking at you're getting the 510K?
We would like to submit the 510K application in September. So, you know, ideally we would have it in the March-April timeframe. In theory you can get a 510K in 3 months. I think you should never count on that. So I think 6 to 9 months is the more reasonable period of time. If we don't have the 510K by the end of March, we would certainly have an indication from the FDA as where we are, because we've already had first questions. And so we would be able to make a decision as whether we might start start the process of ramping up production and doing things like that. Mm-hmm. By end of 2016 will be a big year for us, we think.
Wow. And so Shabir, as you're looking at the organization's growth, I mean, are you going to start staffing up and building the organizational infrastructure as well?
Oh, absolutely. We definitely will need to, in order to support all of these activities, both, you know, clinical data accrual, you know, enrolling more and more subjects, both in the United States and overseas. You know, supporting the regulatory approval process, and of course, you know, setting ourselves up so that we can start manufacturing. all of that is going to require us to, you know, increase our staff. And we're a small, you know, very small staff right now, but this is, you know, this is our future. This is what we need to do. And as Mark said, this is when the work really starts.
Yeah.
So when the work really starts, you have to have the people to do the work.
Yeah. And so as you guys look at Atlanta, you know, there's a burgeoning medical device community in Atlanta. How do you feel about Atlanta as the place to launch and have you and grow your company?
I think Atlanta is a great place to launch and have a company. I mean, you know, one of the things that, you know, we have families in the area. We have children who go to colleges here. You know, one of the things that we often talk about is you know, we have great institutions in the city, but unfortunately, very often we lose our young people who go off and, you know, find jobs elsewhere. And having companies like LumaMed here in Atlanta, I think, and benefiting, if you will, from this workforce, from young people, young ideas, from the enthusiasm they bring to the table, I think that would be great for us. And I think we have excellent institutions here that can support us.
Mm-hmm. And are you guys involved in any of the other kind of medical device technology initiatives that are happening around Atlanta?
Well, both of us attend, we attend meetings and conferences a lot. I have consulted with Georgia Tech. I helped set up the Global Center for Medical Innovation at Georgia Tech. I was also, before we started LumaMed full-time, I was involved in the Venture Lab project at Georgia Tech in terms of trying to mentor companies and sort of bring technologies out of the Georgia Tech environment. I was lucky to have received a lot of help with my first two companies from the Georgia Tech's Economic Development Activity. There's a group there called the ATDC, the Advanced Technology Development Center. And so I've tried to put a little bit back, you know, by doing some volunteering. And I think that that's one of the pillars of innovation in the Atlanta and in Georgia overall is the Georgia Tech Technology Square area right now is really, really thriving.
Mm-hmm. And how are you seeing medical device companies navigate that gap between, you know, the launch and when they can get the venture capital funding? How are they coping? How are people getting through that?
Well, one of the things we faced, even as a public company, was, you know, trying to fund a lot of research and development activities. And also with LumaMed, you know, Shabir and I put some money in ourselves. You know, we have a couple investors. But a real breakthrough came when we were able to get a small business innovative research grant from the National Institute of Health, National Cancer Institute, and that really helped propel the company forward. And this is a mechanism that I think is very important for medical device companies right now. It's helping bridge the gap between friends and family and venture or larger angel investments. It's being able to get support from the National Institute of Health through the SBIR or STTR program. STTR is it requires an institution like Georgia Tech or Emory or somebody like that to partner with you. We started this strategy at Guided Therapeutics, over 10 years ago, and Shabir has been the spearhead actually for bringing in non-dilutive financing from these types of grants. And I personally think he probably has brought in more SBIR funds into the state of Georgia than any other researcher in the state, because wow, his total now is over $6 million.
Yeah.
And so most of that, of course, went to Guided Therapeutics, but we've brought in almost $500,000 for LumaMed, and we're in the process of applying for additional grants, which could total, you know, over the next 12 months, could total another $1.5 million. So I think that as venture capital has moved to a model that reflects wanting revenue, and also a lot of focus on social media and internet type things. I think that the National Institute of Health and that funding mechanism, especially SBIRs, which are only for small businesses, that has become a crucial element in terms of maintaining our competitiveness as a nation in medical device, because it affects patient care. Products are developed here, then our patients have access to them early. And that means our patients get the benefit and they're healthier than patients would be in other countries where maybe things are developed much later.
Mm. And so if folks can't get, so you said that there's one pathway, so, you know, there's friends and, you know, the there's the initial investment by the founders, and there's friends and family, then this STTR, you know, fills the gap between that and venture. Other than that, are there any other solutions for medical device inventors who are kind of in that gap?
Well, there are angel investors, and angel investors in medical device has been a little weak in the Atlanta area historically. But they are starting to move. I think it's helped that we've had a couple big success stories recently. CardioMEMS is one. Mm-hmm. We just saw the EndoChoice IPO. Mm-hmm. And there have been a few more, Inhibitex. And so I think that people are starting to see that there are positive investing opportunities in medical device. And so we are expecting to see the local angel community start to strengthen with regard to medical device investment. As that hasn't really completely gelled yet, LumaMed has sought angel investment from in the Bay Area, in Boston, and in San Diego, where there are more established angel groups. And our most likely sources of funding, other than perhaps some private investment from the Atlanta area, are some of those angel groups that are in those more established areas, such as Boston, San Francisco, and San Diego.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that, you know, if folks do want to invest in LumaMed, that would be something that you would be excited about?
Well, one of the things that is a hallmark of a medical device company that's trying to get to build revenue is you're sort of always raising money. And so, you know, we will have to raise probably a total of $5 to $6 million of total capital before we become, completely established. We probably could be profitable before that. So raising that money will be is certainly takes up a lot of my time and Shabir's time, and will be a big focus as we go forward. You know, and everybody, there are people who will invest in medical device, and I think even some of the venture capitalists maybe start. You know, as some of these IPOs or some newer IPOs in the public markets are more accessible, we may see the venture capitalists start returning to the medical device world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so is there anything else that's, you know, new and interesting, any opportunities to get involved with LumaMed that you'd like our listeners to know about?
Well, you know, certainly investors who are angel investors who are out there, or people, you know, institutional funds, you know, whoever would be interested in LumaMed. You know, one of the, groups out there is doctors, you know, surgeons who use this kind of technology, not just in breast cancer, but in other cancers. They have, as Mark said, there's an interest on their part to see their patients do better. You know, in this day and age where you know, the whole healthcare paradigm is changing, you know, hospitals are getting penalized for readmissions, patients are demanding better care, you know, there is this whole, you know, movement away from a fee-for-service type of a model to, you know, getting to deliver better patient care overall, you know, taking charge of the patient all the way from the beginning to cure. There could be doctors groups, physicians groups, surgeons groups who perhaps would be interested in the LumaMed story, and they can be good investment sources for us, not just from the point of view of bringing in capital needed for us to make the progress we want to, but also to help us, to guide us through the whole process, because they are the eventual users of our technology. So they could actually be good partners for us.
Yeah, and they will also be influencers at the point of decision, right, for actually getting LumaMed into the hospital too, right?
Absolutely.
Right. And as I mentioned too, we have to establish 3 or 4 additional clinical sites. And so we are starting to reach out a little bit to physicians. We attended the American Society of Breast Cancer Surgeons meeting in Las Vegas last year, and did some surveys. And we are reaching out and trying to establish those contacts needed to establish the clinical data that we need. Not so much for FDA approval, but you know, you can't sell a product unless people are sure it works. And the best way to prove that it works is to have a robust history of clinical efficacy.
Right. And so just one question. You mentioned the increased focus on decreasing costs in healthcare. What are your thoughts on how much this might save a hospital in terms of, you know, readmission rates or decreased surgeries? I mean, is there a dollar figure that you have in terms of cost benefit for the hospital that might be?
Well, there's a couple of different factors going on here, but I think that we believe that LumaMed will be adopted if we can show that it is at least revenue neutral for the hospital. In other words, they don't lose money, and if it can provide better patient care. And we think that we achieve that with our product offering. Cost is a very important thing in the launching any kind of a medical device. It really needs to be. We like to call them the three P's. It needs to be better for the patient. It needs to be really better for the provider, you know, typically the hospital, surgeon, physician group. And it really needs to be better for the payer, whoever's writing the check.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can meet all of those three objectives to making it better for all those three, we think you can have a successful product in this environment.
Hmm. So it's revenue neutral. It doesn't necessarily save the hospital
money. Well, at a minimum, I think that would. But we also think that, you know, The current situation really is untenable. It's really hard for women. You know, as you probably know, there have been some very high-profile cases recently. There is this gradual trend towards going, you know, for many years we've shown that breast conservation surgery, research has shown breast conservation surgery has the same outcomes as mastectomies. But because of this repeat rate, you know, a third of them have to be repeated, there's a loss of confidence in the procedure, and women are now beginning to elect for almost prophylactic mastectomies. And that's kind of a reversal of and so what we believe with the LumaMed technology, we can make a big change over there and bring it back to where, you know, people don't have to go through those kind of radical procedures. If a procedure has to be repeated for whatever reason, the outcomes are always worse. And so the need to repeat has to be reduced. And that's where we think our big contribution is going to be.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming and telling us a little bit about LumaMed. If people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
The best way is to look on our website at lumamed.com. That's LumaMed.com. Or they can, and all our contact information is on that website.
Very good. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
This show is brought to you by Annona Enterprises, where strategy is your access to money and performance. Learn more at annonaenterprises.com.